For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Let's get into Daniel chapter 4, which is one of the more unusual chapters really in the Bible for reasons that we'll get into here in just a minute. We're calling it here, Restored from the Insanity of Unbelief. And this is interesting. This is it opens with a psalm, essentially. How great are his signs and how great are his wonders. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and his dominion is from generation to generation. Well, this is a theme that we've seen throughout the book of Daniel up to this point. And in fact, this seems to be one of the main things that God is trying to get over in the mind of the Babylonian king Nebuchadnezzar. And if you've been with us in our study, you've realized that this is not an easy message for Nebuchadnezzar to get, being the most powerful man in the known world at the time, and people surrounding him, basically viewing him as something close to being a god. But here's the weird thing about Daniel chapter 4, and which is that first, Daniel chapter 4 is written in the first person from Nebuchadnezzar's perspective. Let's look at it. It says, starting in verse 1, here's the context. Nebuchadnezzar, the king, to all the people of every nation and every language that live on the earth, may your peace abound. It has seemed good to me to declare the signs and wonders which the Most High God has done for me. And then Nebuchadnezzar utters this incredible psalm of praise to God. And he will end this chapter also in a song of praise to God. So what we see is an amazing thing, that God and Nebuchadnezzar have been sort of going at it like giant titans, like the irresistible force and the immovable object. And that tension between who has the rights to rule the world, whose kingdom is it anyway, this dispute that has been going on for three chapters finds its resolution here in chapter 4. So if you haven't been with us, and even if you have, maybe a little reminder would be helpful just to get a sense of what's really going on as we lead up to this kind of crescendo in the book of Daniel. One of the major subtexts that has been going on is all about Nebuchadnezzar's pride. And so, for instance, in our chapter here this evening, Daniel 4, verses 4 and 30 say, I, Nebuchadnezzar, was at ease in my house and flourishing in my palace. Is this not Babylon the Great, which I myself have built as a royal residence by the might of my power and for the glory of my majesty? Okay, this is a guy who does not have a self-image problem. Look at this. My house, my palace, I myself have built the royal residence by my power and for the glory of my majesty. Okay, well, that's pretty strong language. Here's a guy who's feeling pretty good about himself, about his power, about his authority, about his place in the universe. And yet, so self-deceived about his greatness. And so Daniel has to remind him, you, O king, are king of kings, to whom the God of heaven gave the kingdom, power, strength, and glory. So Daniel's always in there, and he's trying to say, yeah, you are great, Nebuchadnezzar, but there's a God greater than you. And when you measure yourself against the God of heaven, Nebuchadnezzar, you're very small. And Nebuchadnezzar, in his pride is also blind to his cruelty. And this we've seen also in chapter after chapter. So in chapter 1, the fear of the people who are taking care of Daniel and his buddies, that if they don't physically prosper under their dietary restrictions, that he says, you know, Nebuchadnezzar will make me forfeit my head. That's the way he deals with his disappointments. If you don't tell me the dream that I had, you, my counselors, I will tear you limb from limb, he says. And to Daniel's buddies, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, he says, bow down and worship me or I throw you into the furnace. And so here's a guy, you know, and he just, of course, you know, hey, I'm the king and what I say is law and I am as a god to you. So, you know, I have the right to threaten in this way. But, you know, Daniel in every situation is coming back and saying, man, dude, you are so cruel. And don't you realize that, you know, tearing people from limb to limb, how is that a good thing? And so he's attacking Nebuchadnezzar's pride. All three chapters really deal with that. And because why? Because here's the second theme, and which is that God is in pursuit. God is pursuing this man, Nebuchadnezzar. And in two ways. First, by revealing his knowledge to Nebuchadnezzar. And so you have in chapter 2, remember the dream of the statue there. All of Nebuchadnezzar's wise men say, well, only a god could declare the king's dream. Nobody could get inside the king's head. You know, if you tell us the dream, then we can interpret it, but no one can tell you what the dream was. Only God could do that. To which Daniel says, well, there is a God in heaven, actually, who does reveal mysteries. And he says to Nebuchadnezzar, this mystery has not been revealed to me for any wisdom residing in me more than any other living man. What is he saying? He's saying, look, it's not about me. It's about the fact that I keep telling you there is this God of heaven. And this God of heaven knows things that no human being could know. And so after Daniel correctly identifies the dream, the Nebuchadnezzar says, surely your God is a God of gods and Lord of kings and revealer of mysteries. And so you see that Nebuchadnezzar in some ways is beginning to recognize that there is another sovereign in the universe besides himself. And what is that sovereign? Well, it's Daniel's God. It's the God of the Jews. He doesn't say it's my God. He doesn't say it's the God. He says, it's your God. And then we move on in chapter 3, what we talked about last week, a demonstration of God's power to Nebuchadnezzar. And so where they refused to bow down and worship the image that he had made, Nebuchadnezzar threatens Daniel's buddies and he says, what God is there who can deliver you out of my hand? My hand's powerful. No God can go against my will. To which Daniel's buddies say, well, actually, the God we serve is able to deliver us from your hand, O king. And so, you know, they're thrown into the furnace, as you recall, and they're just kind of walking around and they're having a good little party down there in the oven. No one gets burned. And so, as it turns out, they were right, and Nebuchadnezzar has to conclude at the end of chapter 3, blessed is the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who sent his angel to deliver his servants, who placed their trust in him and violated the king's command. The God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. It's the same pattern as in chapter 2. He's realizing, he's seeing there's something to this God. And I'm seeing evidence that I can't just dismiss, but I'm not really ready to commit either. And so I'm going to keep this thing at an arm's length, and it's going to be your God. And that's how we're going to look at this thing, and I'm still master of my domain, and your God is, well, very powerful. I concede, I grant that, but I'm going to stick with what I got, which is me. And God, as it turns out, is not okay with that. And in chapter 4, the Battle of the Titans takes place. And we have basically Nebuchadnezzar's pride against God's remarkable power. And who's going to win? God's going to win. This is how it happens. It's a collision course. These two great powers are going to come together. Let's pick up the narrative. In verse 5, it says, I saw a dream and it made me feel fearful. This is Nebuchadnezzar talking again. And these fantasies, as I lay on my bed and the visions in my mind, kept alarming me. These were the visions in my mind as I lay on my bed. I was looking and behold, there was a tree in the midst of the earth and its height was great. I was looking in the visions in my mind and behold, an angelic watcher, a holy one, descended from heaven. He shouted, chop down the tree and cut off its branches, yet leave the stump with its roots in the ground. Then the vision shifts. And he says, let his mind be changed from a man to a beast. Let 7 periods of time pass over him. And so Nebuchadnezzar is weirded out. He's like, what could this mean? We've seen this pattern before. It says at the end of this vision, this sentence is by decree of the angelic watchers, in order that the living may know that the Most High is ruler over the realm of humanity and bestows kingdoms on whoever he chooses. So now he's kind of getting a little bit closer to what the meaning of these visions are, but how does this relate to him? Well, that has to be explained, of course, again by Daniel, who says in verse 20, the tree you saw is you, O king, for you have become great and grown strong, and your majesty has become great and reached the sky, and your dominion to the end of the earth. And the Most High decrees that you will be driven from humanity and your palace to be with beasts of the field, and you will eat grass like cattle and drenched with dew for 7 units of time until you recognize that the Most High is ruler over humankind and bestows it on whomever he chooses. Oh man, we could have imagined that this is what this is really about. And I'm sure Nebuchadnezzar's fears were realized as Daniel was speaking that he, in fact, is the tree that's cut down and he is the one who is turned over to his insanity as a wild beast. And it raises for us this issue here this evening, the insanity of prideful unbelief, as represented by what happens to Nebuchadnezzar. He ends up with a psychiatric disorder, which is actually known among psychiatrists, called lycanthropy. And lycanthropy is a delusion that comes and goes, apparently. People kind of come in and out of this, where a person believes that they're an animal. So they act like an animal. And so it is that Nebuchadnezzar, about a year, it says, after this vision was interpreted by Daniel, is sitting in his palace and reflecting in his pride of the greatness of his kingdom and the greatness of himself. And this insanity begins to overtake him. And for, it says, a unit of 7 times, whatever that is, most interpreters say it's probably 7 years. Here this man, Nebuchadnezzar, the most powerful man in the world of his day, lapses in and out of thinking that he is a beast, a wild animal. Wow. Pretty weird, but the reason for it is very clear, isn't it? It's given to us twice, and that is so that, or until, both of those terms are used, you realize that there is a God in heaven. In other words, namely, that you are not the last authority on the earth. That's essentially what he's saying there. And so as long as Nebuchadnezzar is willing to hold on to his pride of place, his power, to say that I am the final authority for myself, I am the final authority for all who are in my domain, my kingdom, God says, you will be subject to this insanity, this animalistic delusion. And it will be with you until that moment of clarity comes to you and you choose to yield to the true God of heaven. That's what's going on here. And it raises, I think, a very interesting thought for us, something that's really close to the biblical view of what does it mean to be human, and which is that there's a spiritual dimension to the inner problems that we have, the psychological problems, emotional problems, that these are in many respects the effects of the condition of our heart, which is not to say that there aren't biological bases for psychological problems and emotional problems. I'm not suggesting that. Or that environment doesn't also play a significant role in the experiences of life. Again, those are granted, those are true. But what the Bible does teach is that there is an important, in fact, a critical place in which the condition of our own hearts before Him has huge effect on our psychological and emotional life. And let me just illustrate that in a few ways, because again, this is important for us to understand what God is allowing Nebuchadnezzar to experience. In some ways, we can kind of relate to this, we understand this, because there is this connection between the condition of our heart and the condition of our own minds. So, for instance, the condition of the heart where we have unresolved guilt, we have a moral problem. You know, psychologists of every stripe will tell you that people who carry on unresolved guilt in their life, things that you have done that you just keep close to the chest and that others are not drawn in and it is not resolved, is like poison in your life. And it is possible to become so overcome in bitterness for the things done to us that we are unwilling to forgive, or by shame, the things that we have done and have not been resolved, that it just drives people to a place of neurosis. It shuts out meaningful relationship. It creates huge psychological and emotional problems for people. But the origin of this thing has everything to do with the condition of the heart. Maybe some of you here tonight kind of recognize what I'm talking about here. You know, you just are one of these people who's really been hurt in their life. And you've taken that injury and you have become bitter. You won't forgive. You can't forgive. And so therefore, see, you've become more or less defined by this offense against you. And you're bitter. And that's a lens then that you begin to view every person and every circumstance through. And it's a poison in your life. And its origins are spiritual, because guilt is a spiritual problem and forgiveness is a spiritual cure. Secondly, we can talk about a deep alienation, the relational problems that issue forth from a heart that is not right with God. relational problems when we say to ourselves that I want to really be about me. And I will be involved with other people to the extent that they promote my agenda for me, and I will distance myself from those who do not. That is a condition of the heart that sets ourselves up as this nucleus around which the electrons and neutrons of the universe are supposed to revolve. Maybe we've got some real relational problems that we're just not able and willing to have the humility to resolve. And so as a consequence, a lot of us are walking around our lives with deep insecurities. We don't know how we stack up. We measure ourselves against others and wonder what's wrong with me. So there's a sense of inferiority, perhaps, that you have, or in your competitive self-deceit, you've become arrogant. And nobody's good enough, and no one stacks up to me. Maybe you've got this. Maybe you're paranoid. Everyone's out to get you. I know everyone's out to steal my stuff. It is a fact. My records just keep disappearing. My music, you know, which I love so much, it's like, who's messing with me? You are. You're sneaking into my house and I'm not there. I know. I knew it was you. Paranoia. Anger. This stance that you take that another person exists for the sake of your momentary gratification, your momentary pleasure. And when they've become boring to you or a liability, then it's time to discard them like a piece of trash and move on. And we are very predatory as a culture in how we deal relationally with persons of the opposite sex in which there is interest. Those are conditions of the heart that ruin lives, that drive us further and further away from the reality that God intended for human beings to enjoy. You know, a person who has set their heart against God recognizes how truly alone they really are. This is probably the most difficult thing in the mind of Nebuchadnezzar as he's out there given over to his insanity. And then when he comes out of it and he looks at the slobber all over his body and where did these scratches come from and how come all this haze around and stuff like that, and he just comes out looking all gross and he's like, bow, but I will not yield. And then back into the insanity he goes. You know, and so you get those moments of clarity. And then you say, no! And then right back into that addictive habit. Right back into that place of despair, of cynicism, of your chronic anxieties, of that sense of futility and purposelessness in your life. Look, I'm just describing here the life of the honest soul as he or she reflects on their alienation from God. These are the inevitable places that a heart that is far from God goes. And sometimes for many of us, this is all there is, really. And we are really stuck. And for others of us, we can remember moments of great clarity and we've made progress, but just that ability to fall right back into that pattern of bondage and insanity is right there again. And this is where Nebuchadnezzar is at. And there is this huge battle for his heart. And with everything riding on this battle over his heart, just like there is for you. Just like there is for you. And God is pursuing you just as God was pursuing Nebuchadnezzar. And God's intent is to bring Nebuchadnezzar back to reality. He has allowed him to get to this place of total mental disconnect to reality, with moments of clarity that enable him to take another look and make another decision and either stick his head back in the toilet again or turn to God. And God is appealing within to Nebuchadnezzar during this time. And it says in Daniel 4, verse 26, he says, Daniel says to Nebuchadnezzar, he says, you will receive your kingdom back when you recognize that it is heaven that rules. This is Daniel's consistent message to him. Okay, you've got this, you're clear. Let me remind you again what the issue is here. You need to humble yourself before the God who is there. That's what makes this stuff go away. I will not. Well, okay. See you in the funny papers. You know? It's like that. What's the real issue here? The real issue here is that God is the ultimate authority. This is the ultimate offense to sinful human beings, people whose hearts are in opposition to God. At the heart of everything that is wrong in human history and in human society and in our own hearts, it is a controversy over who is the ultimate authority in my life. Who's the authority? Who do I yield to? Here's an interesting thought here. See, Nebuchadnezzar's injustice is being met by the accountability of God. And so he's experiencing some problems in his life. But it really comes down to this thing, this ultimate authority of God. We were at a little get-together last night, Linda and I were. And oddly enough, one of the guys at this party was an old colleague of mine. A political science professor that I'd worked with for several years, and we had known each other pretty well. And it's like, so, where you been? And you had a tenure-track position. Why did you leave? And I'm like, well, let me tell you about that. And, you know, the God thing comes up, and it becomes awkward, and you know how that is. But this guy is a leading socialist, actually, is what he is. And so he's talking about, you know, the way society ought to be. And, you know, just if we could set aside selfishness and think about the common good and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, I'm resisting the thought of asking him what he's been smoking lately and stuff like that, because we realize it's not the way the universe operates. But I asked him at a certain point, I said, you know, how does God fit into that for you? And he's like, well, you know, it's funny. I did my doctoral dissertation on the origins of socialism in America. I just realized that universally the basis of it was a biblical Christian community. I'm like, yeah, well, okay, that's good. And like, so, you know, what do you think about that? Well, he says, you know, there is a basis for sacrifice and stuff like that in the Bible. And I'm like, yeah, there is. And so we kept on talking about it and stuff. And he's just like, well, so I finally just said, Bob, where are you at with this God thing? You know, haven't seen in 20 years, but how's it going with God? You know. And he goes, well, you know, in my heart, I want to believe. In my head, I'm not able to do that. He said, but I have to believe that ultimately justice is served in the universe. And I'm like, okay. Now, if that's true, let's think about what kind of universe that has to be and who is in authority in the universe. And so then we talk about other things. But This is a huge deal. All of our aspirations, all of our sense of justice, those things mean nothing unless there is a God in heaven that rules. Otherwise, what do we have? The struggle for the survival of the fittest. Man is the measure of all things. All of these little slogans that have driven human history and human society into the ground. And God is trying to speak to that, to this man, and he's saying it doesn't have to go down like that. And in fact, there is a God who, in heaven who rules and whose will be served in the end. And I'm pursuing you, Nebuchadnezzar, not only because I'm going to use you, even though you defy me, to serve my purposes in the world, but because I love you. And Nebuchadnezzar is this object, ironically, of the relentless love of God. This defiant, cruel, heartless, tyrannical, megalomaniac who barks like a dog is the object of God's relentless love, and he's pursuing him. He's pursuing him because he loves him. He's pursuing him because in Nebuchadnezzar is such a clear demonstration that no one is beyond the pale of God's love. No one's too far. No one's too corrupt. No one's too whatever. Too gone. And so in that sense, what an awesome picture that is. And so there is this plea then for a change of course. And God is appealing through Daniel. He says in verse 27, O king, may my advice be pleasing to you. Break away now from your sins by doing right and showing mercy to the poor. Boy, that sense of urgency is there, isn't it? Break away now. You've had the evidence already, 3 chapters worth of evidence, that I am who I say I am. And now you are at this place where I'm calling you to respond, and I'm saying, don't delay here. Break away now from this contention that you have. Break away now. And, you know, when we don't break away now, there's a problem. Then we just got to go through yet another cycle here, just like this guy. Until when? Until we're worn out. And so, you know, imagine after maybe years of this, apparently, Nebuchadnezzar finally has this, you know, a moment of clarity. And it's a little different than the moments of clarity that he had before, where he went right back to the straw and the fields out there with his 4-legged buddies. And he's like, okay, I get it. I'm tired of this. I'm ready. Okay, God, uncle. Okay. And so that's the picture that we're given with here, right here. And what I'm asking you is, you know, we're like Nebuchadnezzar in the same, we have the same sort of heart that he is, not in a category that's unique from the rest of us. And we resist God just as he has resisted God. And we come to these moments of clarity. And I'm asking you, as you are worn out by this marriage that just sucks. Why? Because you're so selfish, that's why. You're so selfish. And why you can't get it on to actually put the interests and the needs of somebody else before yours, and you're nursing these bitternesses and these various reasons for why, well, I'll move if they move first, or whatever you have convinced yourself is really just. And we're resisting God. And he's asking you Are you worn out? Are you tired? Are you prepared to break away now? Because it's not going to go away, and it's always going to come back to this thing, and you're going to be at this place of decision. A lot is going to be lost in the meantime. Let's make that decision now. Now. Some of you have listened to the message of the gospel, the good news about Jesus Christ, that he came into the world and he took upon himself the burden of your guilt, and he died the death that you deserve so that God could offer you forgiveness in him. And you've heard that message, but you have not said, I need to break away now, and I need to stand under that. And we've just put it off and put it off, and what has transpired but yet another cycle of insanity, of unresolved stuff in our lives. And the author of Hebrews says in Hebrews chapter 3, if you hear my voice, do not harden your hearts. Today, now is the time of salvation. Now's the time. Not in some nebulous point in the future when I get around to it, but right now. Right now is the time for us to go before God to say, I want that death that you died to count for me. I'm prepared to receive that. And now's the time for many of us who are in a standoff in our close relationships, and where we are within ourselves, we've been drawing lines and we're saying, I will not, and I will not, and I will not. To make a break from that now, to call it what it is, to say to God the truth, I've been living for self, I'm a selfish person, I'm living for what's gratifying to me, I'm not yielding my life to you, and I see that is madness, it's madness, and now's that time. Break away from that. See, God's always there for you. He gives you those moments of clarity. He gives you those opportunities to respond. They will not always be there. They will not always be there. They're there right now. Respond. Respond to Him. I think that it's true. I believe this. I see this so many times in relationships that matter to me and people whose lives I've tracked with for many years. No matter where you are, you could be as crazy as Nebuchadnezzar. And I hope you're not. But I fear you are. It's not true. You know, we're really just a decision away from reality. Just a decision away from trusting God with these things in our life that are driving us to madness. Just to say, I repent. I want to break away, God, from this. I want to trust you with this thing in my life. And when we are able to be honest like that, and just make that decision, and we share that decision with someone who's going to understand that decision and help us walk through, how do I respond to this? Our lives will change. Broken, crippled lives, shattered marriages, lives change when people make decisions like this. And it's not, people change quickly often when this is the case. And then there is this hope of God's blessing. It says, now Nebuchadnezzar, he has that moment of clarity. And now after however many years it's been, he responds and he says, I raised my eye toward heaven and my reason returned to me. Okay, just clip that out. Stick that on your refrigerator right there. I raised my eyes toward heaven and my reason returned to me. That's how you stay sane. He says, my counselors and nobles began seeking me out, so I was reestablished in my sovereignty. and surpassing greatness was added to me. He didn't wake up to the swagging finger. That's about time, Nebuchadnezzar. It says he became sane and that God granted him surpassing greatness. He responded to God and God blessed him. What are your expectations for God's involvement in your life? If you have that moment of clarity and you're willing to turn to Him and turn from these things that have been vying for your heart and that you have been given over to, what are your expectations? What Nebuchadnezzar learned is what children of God throughout time have learned, which is that when we entrust ourselves to God, He is merciful, He's gracious, and it's His desire to bless us. He wants to bless your life. He wants your life to improve. His desire is not to hold you down and put His foot on your neck and say, "Now look who's boss." That's not God's thing. God just wants to put you in a humble place so that you can receive from His mercy and from His goodness. He wants to bless your life. Awesome. And lastly, there is this amazing end to the story. It says, think about this, this is who this guy is. This guy is a pagan living in great darkness. And he's had this interaction with God and he says, "I, Nebuchadnezzar, I praise, exalt, and honor the King of Heaven. For all His works are true and His ways just, and He is able to humble those who walk in pride." This terrible man has written a chapter of Scripture. This terrible man has met the living God. This terrible man is our brother with whom we will share eternity. And it's just kind of an amazing thing. Over these years, and he's seen some things, and he's seen some more things. And finally, God, because He's relentless in His love, has pursued this guy, and they've come to this crossroads, and Nebuchadnezzar has yielded. And now, man, he sees with such clarity, the clouds are gone. He gets it. He understands what it's about. He's met the living God. He's met the living God. That's so sweet. Isn't that amazing? You can know the living God. The God who is able to humble the prideful. Like that other person. Yourself. What was I thinking? And to have a spontaneous sort of a response to that. True humility results in praise. Just because when you're humble, we realize just how magnificent God is. Magnificent in His power. Magnificent in His wisdom. Magnificent in His mercy toward us. And so there's this incredible connection that what's in our hearts is that inclination, that desire to draw people's attention to the greatness and the goodness of God. That's what it means to praise Him. And when we are humble, that's the impulse. That's what we want to talk about. That's what we want to express to other people. That's what we want to sow into the fabric of our relationships and what our life is about. We want to live as a sort of, let me tell you about how awesome God is. And so I ask you here, as we close, what reason do you have to praise and exalt and honor God tonight?
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.